This is Scott Allen from odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
This is Scott Allen, and I'm the MC for this week of a technology roundtable with John Galloway, Scott Kuhn, and Kevin Dente. Last week, we saw the release of a Visual Studio 2008 and .NET Framework 3.5 Service Pack 1 beta version that came loaded with more features than bug fixes, I think. There was the ASP.NET dynamic data. There was the new ASP.NET routing engine. There were new AJAX components. There was JavaScript formatting and IntelliSense, additional capabilities added there. We also had classic ASP IntelliSense and debugging added into Visual Studio, which kind of makes you wonder just how many people were still
That's
demanding
that.
That.
No comment.
And all sorts of performance improvements and slimming down of the CLR if you want to deploy a click once application, WPF and performance improvements. And so you just have to wonder, the first question is, why wasn't this .NET 3.6? And Kevin, you had an interesting comment on that.
Oh, yeah, well, sometimes I think sneaking service packs past the IT development or the IT support wolves is a little easier than sneaking a whole new version past them, which often involves recertification of platforms and rolling out new images and blah, 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 blah. So it's a convenient way, I think, to backdoor some new functionality. And now that's just me being, somewhat snarky and jaded, but.
Well, you can certainly walk up to the IT department and say, hey, you need to install a service pack. It has security fixes.
Right.
They're not talking
There's some merit in that, though.
Well, I guess it does have some fixes. It's just nobody's talking about them that much. Like, I know that there's some performance fixes for Visual Studio, but there's got to be some actual like bug fix stuff.
I don't know. I'm starting to wonder whether Microsoft has given up on the whole fixing bugs thing because of the backward compatibility risks they might face. So just put out new features.
New features and the old features as designed.
Exactly.
Is anybody
well,
using
there's some
it?
Merit to the idea that you're sneaking something past IT. We were having a brief conversation this afternoon on Twitter, the 5 to 10 minutes it was up, where someone was trying to convince them to go from .NET 2.0 to 3.5. And he was just, smacking his head against the wall. He could not get them to take it. Even though, that 3.5 is built on the 2.0 CLR. So in theory, it's not like you're risking a lot.
It's got to be like if you look at the version numbers and it's really scary. It's, oh my gosh, it's 1.5. But then you look at, it's running on the 2.0 CLR, and then it's got some new features and some fixes, but a lot of the features are things that I was trying to respond to it was Keith Rule that was asking the question. I was trying to respond to him and Twitter kept crashing and I finally just gave up. But part of it,
Access 2 had the same issue when they went from 2 to 7.
Yeah. Or Java.
Suddenly IT departments are going, we missed 5 versions.
What are we doing? We've got to catch up.
Yeah. We're gonna start on 3 first, and then maybe we'll install 7.
So has anyone tried it?
I installed it on one computer, and nothing blew up. But then I'm also the Silverlight tools don't work with it. The released Silverlight tools don't work with it. And so that was something where I kind of needed to hold off. And I know that that's something that's, there's a new release following shortly after, but as of now, I just haven't gotten deep into it. I have to say the one thing that I'm surprised at to be interested in the dynamic data thing. I initially wasn't really that interested in it from the things I'd seen before, and then I saw an overview of it at the MVP Summit, and I really thought it was pretty interesting. You know, kind of the idea of scaffolding and all that, but it generates out a lot of code, which, you know, in the past people would be like, oh, I don't want all this generated gunk, but it really seems like it's a good kind of clean way in that it doesn't kind of box you into a corner. Because like most frameworks like that will work for a certain point and then you're screwed. And this really seems like it's pretty flexible.
So without dragging his name into this, when Rob Connery was hired by Microsoft, he kind of said, you know, they're hiring me to maintain Subsonic. And then they come out with dynamic data, which sounds like it kind of does exactly the same thing that Subsonic does. So, well, what's Rob doing?
Yeah, so I've talked to him.
I know he's working on MVC, too.
Yeah. He's in an, kind of like a... His role is very interesting. Like, and it's like, you know, I've talked to him, and it takes a while to describe it. But it's kind of like to build cool stuff on top of the frameworks. And so on top of MVC, you know, adding in, you know, like building out examples, and but also building in showing using Subsonic with it. I know that he's, you've seen things go by on Twitter, and I've talked to him about some of the work he's doing on Link to Subsonic, which is not easy. But so he is actively working on that. But yeah, it is true. I mean, there's similar, they solve similar purposes. They go about it in different ways, but there's similar intent to it. Because, I mean, both of these are looking at plugging your data into a user interface quickly and in a way that, like, it's quick, but it's not like dragging a data grid onto a form where you've lost control of it and you've got to hook events to change it. So, but there's some, like, on the surface, they're doing kind of the same things, but then if you look under the hood, there's some big differences in how they're working. Mostly, and I don't want to keep babbling too much, but mostly in that the way that dynamic data is set up, my understanding is that it hooks into a model using the, and by model I mean like the Link to SQL model or the Entity Framework model. So it hooks into those, whereas Subsonic does more of generate out an object data model. And it
uses plain old .NET objects as well?
Yeah.
With like annotations or?
It's
no, annotations.
I don't even know what
they're,
that
they're
is.
Called attributes. attributes.
Yeah, no, it's more like Active Record. It's collections. It's, you know, it's lists of types of objects.
No Java terminology, please.
Sorry.
Is it generating web form code?
Well, it builds a stack. So the first step is, the first thing they came out with was like, look, here's a data. They used the, I forget what it's now called, a build provider. So he hooked into build provider and generated out just some, whatever, POCOs, you know, like it's just Active Record C# objects. So that was cool. Hmm. But the first way he did it, since it was a build provider, was it was just kind of a hidden assembly. Like, you never even saw the code. And then that was neat. It was pretty slick, and it looked really nice on a demo. But then people would say it's not that maintainable and all that. So then he put a lot of work into building out – he and some other people, Eric Kemp, did a ton of work on it. But they built out a generator that does actually generates code. It uses partial classes. It's really like – I look at the, you know, like a lot of time something just spits out a lot of code and you go like, well, great, but the code's probably crap. And I look at these classes and I go, man, that's some pretty slick code. Like it's really well factored and they've sweat over the, you know, exactly how they're structured. So, and then again, here I'm babbling again, but the idea is that, so then they built out this data model stuff. And then on top of it, they're like, well, now we can do some stuff with this data model. Like we can build out, there's a lot of different controls that just declaratively hook right into the data model, and then there's also the scaffold control. And it's pretty similar to this dynamic data again, but it's a pretty intense scaffold control that does all the, you know, if it sees a foreign key, it creates a dropdown. If it sees a date, it does a calendar pop-up, you know, that kind of stuff. So,
the thing that kind of intrigued me about it was that Microsoft and Apple, too, IBM to a lesser extent, always get accused of kind of squashing open source projects by releasing something, you know, that has the official corporate stamp of approval on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, MS test versus NUnit, MBUnit, yada, yada. And here's a case where they actually hired someone and they're in essence, the open source project is competing against, you know, the Microsoft product. So it's almost like they're supporting their competition, you know, either indirectly or in some cases directly.
It's interesting. And it's a weird setup. And there's times where Rob is working with the guys in dynamic data and getting, you know, kind of trying to keep things, you know, like in places where there's no need to differentiate to kind of agree on something and stuff. So it's interesting. But yeah, I think that's great. And it's kind of the whatever, let a thousand flowers bloom or at least two, you know, like and just kind of here's some options, you know, here's one that's under MIT license, Subsonic's under MIT license, and that was one of Rob's conditions when he joined Microsoft. And then there's, you know, dynamic data, which is not under, it's under a proprietary license and you can't have it, you know, but you can use it. So, but that's definitely a much bigger kind of question that you're alluding to is that, you know, how Microsoft works with open source or how big companies work with open source. Which is maybe a question.
Yeah, maybe we'll save that for next week.
Yellow sticky. Oh, yeah,
I wasn't ready to dive into that one.
Well, one other big can of worms that you didn't completely dive into, but when you're talking about new features, that they've got this entity framework thing.
That's not a can of worms, man. That's a can of vipers.
So I'm amazed at how passionate people are about the entity framework, either for or against it. It's just, it's so polarizing.
I'm seeing a lot more against than for right now.
But I wonder if it's just that the people, is that just, you know, some of the, Microsoft is competing within Hibernate and with, you know, other ORMs. And, you know, maybe that's the initial reaction. And then over time, the IT shops will see it and go, hey, great, we can stop writing our own data access and we can kind of, you know, people that wouldn't normally look at Hibernate. I don't know.
Yeah, I think Hibernate does factor into some of the anger that floats around. And if only in the sense that for years now, people have been waiting for Microsoft to produce a product like this, something that was beyond type data sets, something that took more of a object-oriented view and allowed you to work with C# classes instead of something that maps to a database schema almost from the start. And that's been going on for years now. So when the entity framework was first announced, people were skeptical from the start, but what they delivered just is very frustrating to anyone who's been working with a technology like Hibernate for a couple of years, because it's not designed to work the way people expect an object relational mapper to work, which is first. Entity framework really does seem to take a data first approach, and it's saying things like build a conceptual model over the data and then use it in different services and across different domains, and everything will be beautiful. And a lot of people that look at that said, you know, we've kind of tried that in the past too. It just never works out. So if that's where you're spending all of your energy building towards that vision, we just, you know, there's some people that just don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. And I get frustrated with the entity framework for that reason and for other reasons. I think it's been developed in isolation, really. Someone had a grand vision of how this was supposed to work and just sort of drove that vision, but they didn't listen or pay attention to what was happening in the rest of the world.
was there any kind of like course correction? I mean, there was a huge response. I mean, that's my understanding is that's pretty much where the alt.net kind of movement coalesced is out of response to that. Like, you're building something that we don't want, and you know, like, listen, listen to us and listen to what, listen to lessons that others have learned when they've tried to do this thing. But so I guess, that, you know, did they listen? And I don't know. That's okay. I don't know much about this, to be honest.
Well, so my first question, anytime I hear of someone building a framework at Microsoft, is I'm saying, okay, so who's using it internally? And, you know, so the answer is usually, well, we got this one guy who's doing something. And, you know, you're like, well, one guy does not a focus group make. You know, and traditionally, you know, there's not a lot of call for something like Entity Framework to be used inside of Microsoft. Because they already have, you know, a lot of tools that, you know, for bugs, for reporting, for everything. So, you know, I don't know where they would dog food it really, unless they were just building samples.
Yeah.
So maybe the key is that they need to. Gosh, I don't know. You wouldn't really want to put it out to CTP too quick because no one's going to be building anything serious with it and really putting it through its paces. You know, to get early feedback on it because it's, you know, at that point it wouldn't even be beta when they would release it. It would just be conceptual.
I don't know what the downside is of early releases, though. You know, like MVC, I mean, it's obviously kind of the shining example of the opposite approach, where they've released things early and gathered feedback and made some kind of big changes based on that. I don't know. I really like the idea of just get something out there and let people react. I'm thinking that, you know, this or like the classic example for me always is the Internet Explorer team, where it's kind of like, here you go, hope you like it, you know, as opposed to everybody else, you know, where you get to see, you could probably look at Firefox 4 if you wanted right now, you know, some kind of really build.
Some of the response I've seen from the Microsoft people has been sort of the typical Microsoft thing, which is, oh yeah, we didn't really know that was going to be such a big deal, we'll fix it in the next version. So in other words, it's another case of by the time we see it, it's too late to really change anything.
Yeah.
And that's perpetually frustrating.
And it's hard then because there's so much that you can't fix in the next version without... You never want to break backward compatibility with a big framework.
Right.
So you end up just kind of stuck.
And yet, and historically, when you look at the products that have been the most stable on release or you know, the, let's say, from Microsoft, they've been like... the Office components, so Word, NT4, and Visual Studio has traditionally been pretty stable on release, you know, VisualStudio.net notwithstanding, I guess. That was the original one, though, when they first came out with it. So, and I think that's been because they're tools that they have to use internally, so they dog food very early. I mean, the NT4 team, basically, they were using NT, you know, before it had much of anything.
Another example, like, it's just to piggyback on what you're saying, is IIS. I mean, that's something where they're always dogfooding
right
early on, and it shows, you know. I mean, it's usually pretty solid when it ships.
Mm-hmm. And Visual Studio, you know, they start having to debug inside of what they're building pretty quick. You know, so they're very focused on, we got to get this up and running because I don't want to waste 2 months of my life trying to debug, you know, myself. So I don't know. Maybe if they were able to get their financial division, you know, the accounting people to start, you know, the people that do that support to start building apps using things like EF and MVC early on. You know, put it through a real world test, but you know, you can do it internally.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know though.
I'd much rather see that process happening outside of Microsoft. I mean, to a certain extent, Microsoft is not a typical company, and they're not necessarily always the best people to dog food their own stuff.
That's true. That's true.
It's one of the complaints I've heard about Team Foundation Server, is that it's sort of you know, it's built for people who build software like Microsoft, but that's not everybody.
Where you've got a bunch of people on one big domain and I mean, you
don't have not a lot of distributed stuff.
Yeah. There's the dog fooding thing, but also, like, I was just thinking that one thing of the involving the community early on is just that it's a process. You know, even if there's, like, you work through some issues together and maybe you end up with saying, like, you know, we're going to end up where we were thinking, but here's why, and we've talked to you, and just the act of, like, you know, talking, you know, like, involving the community, there's less hostility towards it as opposed to, like, you jerks, why didn't you ask, you know?
Right.
Yeah, the other thing that's kind of bugged me about the Entity Framework, especially this week, is
this particular week.
Yeah, this week. Well, something I just sort of put together, just sort of clarified in my mind, and I don't want to start any conspiracy theories or anything, but it was just at the beginning of this month. I mean, it was maybe 2 weeks ago, Matt Warren had a blog post, and Matt Warren's the guy who pretty much wrote all of Link to SQL. He had a blog post about why didn't we make the data context class an interface, or why didn't we make it easy to mock to do TDD. And one of the things in this blog post, one of the things he wrote was that the data context has a provider model, and he says that originally this could have been something where other providers could have plugged in. So you could have had like a simple link to Oracle or a link to MySQL or whatever. And he said that provider model was disabled just before release. Don't ask me why. Just be satisfied to know that it was not a technical reason. And I'm thinking this was some sort of political move inside of Microsoft that said, we need to push the Entity Framework as the framework for people to use for data access. So we don't want sort of Link to SQL looking like it's as powerful as the Entity Framework. And that's kind of been bugging me. Because one of the things that the Entity Framework they cheer about is that within 3 months of their Oracle and DB2 and so forth. So that's my conspiracy theory for the week.
Well, just in keeping with
Matt
the
Warren was on WinFS and Object Spaces early on too, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's been through all this, and that's why I find Link to SQL a lot more to my taste than the Entity Framework.
Now, Link to SQL is more database first too, isn't it? Though, I mean, you were saying
to
that
me,
was
it looks like Datasets 2.0.
It's, I mean, the way it's demoed is people always bring up the Link to SQL class designer in Visual Studio, and then you drag and drop some tables from the Server Explorer, and it just code gens a bunch of stuff for you. But the truth is you can sit down and just write public class person and write some C# code, and then later on you can decide, okay, it's time to save this thing into a database. So you create a little XML file that says type person goes to table dbo.person, and then just start persisting those objects. And there's even a create database call on the Link to SQL data context, which I don't think is there in Entity Framework, but I could be wrong. So if you have all these, if you have a mapping file and you have all your objects ready, it's really easy to just fire up a data context, point it to a what's it called, the SQL mobile engine called Create Database, and you have a little in-memory database where you can persist objects. It's actually kind of nice.
I looking at it, we used it on a project, linked to SQL, and there were some frustrating things, like especially if you're working through the designer. If you make a change to a table, you basically, like if you add a new key, you need to basically delete the tables out of your data model and add them back in, and then it'll pick up. You know, there's no like real update.
Yeah,
that really killed me.
Yeah,
when I first started using Link to SQL, is like that one feature, which is I encountered within 5 minutes of using it.
Right,
like flipped the bozo bit on Link to SQL for me.
I remember especially you coming me from, that now. Yeah, when I started looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, like, hello, things change. And coming from the, like, the analysis services 2005 world, where it's, it has, you know, you can say, okay, refresh from my data source, and it'll say, okay, these are the new tables, and these are the changes. Do you want to accept them? And you say, yes. It's like such a no-brainer. And yet, it's just this huge missing feature to me.
Yeah, but
I did find that the classes it created and the way that there were partials and that you could do, I mean, it was really, the class point of view worked well. There were some issues with the data context where there's trouble, you know, you get into trouble with doing things more complex on the data context. You can't do anything more than just, you need to pretty much leave them be, it seems like.
Yeah, and I'm not trying
so let's talk about the fact that it's 2008 and we're still thinking about where the database is and what it's doing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the fact that we even have to conceptually model out databases, and yeah, after the technology is what? God, what was the first relational database? Was it in the 70s?
Well, that's when all the 60s? Relational algebra, all the theory behind it came out, and then...
Wasn't Oracle actually the first?
Yeah. Well, Sybase was pretty early. I don't know where Oracle fit into that.
Yeah, I'm not sure about
but
that.
But anyway, you know, so it's almost like there's two schools of thought. There's developers, and there's databases. You know, there's people who write databases, and they're not really talking. And, you know, the idea that we still have to have this, you know, we have to think about how we're going to persist our data just seems kind of odd to me. It seems like a lot of that should be optimized out. So, now, you know, we don't have to think about, you know, okay, so how many joins is this going to be? We just save it, and it automatically is able to optimize it the best way for us. Like the database engine should be doing that.
So now it should be doing that, and then but then there's questions on, like, how do you report from that, or how do you do analysis from, like, what is the structure of that data?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I don't know. So there's do you query just pure objects, like with something like Link to SQL or Link, or do you need the, is SQL still valid or SQL still relevant? You know, in this kind of a world, this prime utopia. Where we don't have to worry about how we're persisting things.
Well, one thing about SQL that has always struck me is that SQL has been around a lot longer than most current development platforms. In other words, the development platforms come and go, but the databases and the data in them stick around for a long time. So, you know, when people talk about, you know, object databases and storing .NET objects natively and all that sort of stuff, you know, I work at a company where the product has gone from being in Lisp to VB6 to .NET, and there will probably happen something beyond .NET. And the only reason that you can do that kind of stuff is that data sits in that relational database, which is, you know, outside of the comings and goings of the programming world.
Yeah. I mean, because the underlying data is what's, that's like the jewels of the system, you know? I mean, it's like the code can come and go, and that's, but it's like your customer list and your orders and your, you know, like that's the, as far as business is concerned, that's the real value, and that's your value that the IT shop has.
So it looks like the first relational database was MicroDBMS from the IBA, let's see, University of Michigan. The first commercial one was a, what's it say, Multics Relational Data Store, first sold in 1978. And then, of course, Ingres and the other, you know, IBM ones came. So yeah, so we're going on 30 years of databases, and Have they changed much in 30 years? I wonder what the first ones were like.
You know,
they certainly haven't. They don't seem like they've changed a lot in 20 years.
No. I mean,
they're all based on COD's relational model, so.
Yeah. There's some interesting things, like I was looking at, and I'm not, you know, I'm not doing a whole lot with databases at the moment, but there's some interesting things, like in Visual Studio, or I mean in SQL Server 2008, and I'm sure that other databases are doing the same kind of thing, where there's spatial types, and there's XML types. XML in a database never made me too happy, but you know, spatial types is interesting, where it's not only GPS coordinate kind of things, but they can be spatial as in regards to, you know, I don't know, positions, like spatial coordinates on a building or spatial coordinates in a city, you know, and so you can say, you can directly query for, give me the nearest point to this, you know, row in the database. I mean, there's some interesting things, but fundamentally, it's all the same kind of thing. Like you're saying, it's a relational database.
I don't know. We may want to revisit this in a later podcast, because this seems like a, you know, kind of a large topic. You know,
yeah, I mean, it is. Because
we can go down the object database path, which, you know, people keep flirting with, but there's never been one that has really been fast that I've heard of. Or at least, you know, there's always fears of not scaling. So
On 10 years ago, I was on a team and we tried an object-oriented database called Object Store, and we were writing all C++ code, and we actually delivered the first version of a product using Object Store. And then the problem came up of how to. There were two problems that came out. One is to migrate data to the next, you know, migrate, essentially do schema changes on that required C++ code. And also the operations people and the customer service people and the executives wanted ad hoc reports out of that object database, which meant we had to devote a C++ programmer to write those things, which wasn't pretty. And my memories of it was that it was ugly. I mean, and part of the problem was C++, which was native code, and you had to decorate classes with all sorts of macros and follow all sorts of rules to get it to work right. I haven't looked at object databases since then. I imagine on a managed runtime they might be a lot more palatable, but you'd still run into some of those same issues, I think, with you know, reporting and so forth.
I'm wondering now if, you know, like, you know, you always run into this kind of, like, there's a paradigm switch between, like, code, regardless of how you structure it. I mean, it's procedural at some point. And then you've got data, which is, it's set theory, you know, and you're saying, give me everything that matches this value, you're doing set operations. And, you know, maybe something's going to happen where, like, as we get things like Link and we start getting querying built into languages, that the two kind of meet in the middle somewhere, where we can say, you know, like a database can just make sense in saying, I've got a customer object, and I can give you an I list of that customer object and just pass in a, you know what I mean? Maybe there's some kind of way to, as we move towards that. But up till now, I don't think the programming languages have been ready to connect with the databases.
Right. And I mean, you always have to worry about those situations where I have an order that has four line items in it, and I want to remove those four line items, and my infrastructure, my ORM or whatever it is, has to issue four separate delete statements to the database. That's always sort of...
Or
4 million, right? That's when it becomes a problem. But, I mean, those sort of issues are just... They're tough, and I guess they're still being dealt with. And I'm sure the entity framework will take all that pain away.
We know.
And give us whole new kinds of pain.
Well, now that I say that, you know, actually there has been a move away from RDBMSs. But with Google's Bigtable... And some things, you know, related to that.
Yeah, that's true. And if you look at a lot of the service-oriented architectures, they're really talking about The database used to be a point of integration for a lot of applications, and in fact, in the healthcare industry where I work, people are still, I mean, you go to the database, you build new applications, and they all share a database, and it's just a nightmare. But when you look at some of these SOA initiatives, a lot of people are saying that the database doesn't get shared. The only thing we exchange now are messages, which gives you a different perspective and a different type of architecture.
The CA Big bioinformatics grid is all built around messaging and you know, sharing of generic types versus actual schemas.
But at some level, I mean, that does abstract things and it helps take it away as an integration point, but somewhere you got to store the data. And then, you know, like I keep thinking, and you know, we were talking earlier about Twitter as being like an interesting service and yet a completely...
Speaking of scalability.
Service. Yeah.
Or not.
Right. But it's like,
yes,
to me... Apparently
they had to reboot their main database today. And I
so
said,
there you, go.
You guys have a main database?
Like this, that totally... And,
I think
you know,
I've identified a problem.
Exactly. Like I would think anything, I mean, they've got millions in funding. They've been around, you know, they've had some time to think about this problem. You'd think that they'd have a good, like, you know, write-only database, and they'd have several readable databases, and they'd have caching built in the web servers. You know, I mean, this doesn't seem like a hard problem.
Well, and it's not like Evan Williams doesn't know how to scale something, or maybe he doesn't. He's the guy that started Blogger. But I seem to recall that early Blogger releases had some, you know, uptime issues as well. But I'd hesitate to say that it's Evan Williams' problem. Is it Evan Williams or yeah.
It's always fun to play the armchair architect and say, well, you know, this should be easy for them to solve. But the one thing,
they just use in a Hibernate.
Right. I don't know anything about how their system is built, but it does seem like a lot of their blog posts when they say they're explaining one of the problems, you know, what problem happened. It's like, you know, one of our cache servers went down. Like, okay, so one machine went down and it absolutely creamed the site's performance. Like, that's the kind of stuff that makes me go, whoa.
Took the whole site offline. Yeah, exactly. It's like, where's your farm, you know? And what's
right. Meanwhile, I'm reading about how Facebook has 10,000 servers. I'm like, seems like there's a little disconnect here.
Yeah, like we were joking earlier about, you know, Google. It's like, is Twitter down website? And it often says yes. And it's like, is Google down website? You know, I mean, there's no point. You know, and it's like Google runs on commodity. I mean, they're designed to run on any server can go down and no one's going to know.
So do you think Twitter will ever get their act together or... It hasn't been getting any better.
No, in fact, it seems like it's been getting worse. Mm-hmm. Recently, anyway.
You know,
it almost seems like every maintenance notice is just like a notice that, you know, we're going to be down for the next couple of days.
Yeah. I almost kind of wonder, it's like, they've got this big network, it's a free service, and, you know, like, by big network, it's like, I could decide to leave Twitter, but all my friends are there, so I'd be back in 2 days anyhow. And I think that they've kind of got, I don't know if it's intentional, but it sure feels like they're kind of like, nobody's going to leave. We can, you know, they've gotten kind of slack. Because everyone's like, oh, Twitter, you're so great, and nobody's going to quit. They could probably be down for a day a week, and they'd keep most of their users. You know?
Are you saying they're the New England Patriots the week before the Super Bowl?
But we could pick another topic here, which would be NinJect. This is a new dependency injection tool that I think Scott's been playing with. Is that right?
And the fact that we're discussing on a podcast will make Nate just giddy, I think.
Well, I'm completely uninformed. It looked really, the website is pretty cool, I'll tell you that.
Sold. Oh, that is actually pretty cool.
Rounded corners and some cartoon characters. That's all we need out of a framework, really.
Cartoon.
If in Hibernate had the dancing cartoon bears, we'd be set. So I did use it some this weekend. I used Ninject. This is the first DI framework I'd ever used.
Okay.
And, you know, before I'd always kind of done it by hand, and I didn't realize that I was doing a dependency injection. I just thought I was, you know, doing stuff. So I actually used it this weekend to kind of separate some things out, and it was so incredibly easy to use. I felt embarrassed about not having used it before. You know, the fact that
that's going up on the website as a quote.
The fact that you could use the Fluid interface to do all your bindings. And I personally like the idea of using attributes to mark, you know, constructors as something that needs to be injected, injectable.
Mm-hmm.
It could do public field injection. It could do method injection. Do property injection.
Constructor injection.
A whole lot of work into this. And constructor injection, yeah.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk about
work
like
on this? And
do you want to talk about? I don't know if we want to. What level we want to talk at? Do you want to explain like what are some of the selling points of why you'd want to use an injection framework?
Because otherwise, the alt.netters will yell at you and call you names.
Well, for instance, in your code, I mean, you wanted to make it so that you could swap out. I mean, your data
source, so, right? I mean, in my case, I wanted, you know, I didn't want there to be any kind of dependency, other than the interface, on, you know, anything. And that's kind of the thing I found difficult about interface kind of based programming was that at some point you've got to new something up, and you can't new up interfaces everywhere.
Mm.
And so by just, you know, by using this framework, I was able to make the data layer that I was trying to use injectable. And so I didn't really have any dependencies directly on the concrete class. I just had them all using the interface. So nowhere was I really newing it up. The framework was doing it for me. And so that seemed to, for some reason, it mitigated my fears. And I'm sure you could do that without using a framework. But the framework makes it a lot easier, I guess.
The ones I've looked at before have all been heavily, you know, they're XML mapping. You know, like you set up XML configuration that says, you know, when I want to new this, create it from here, and when I want to new this, create it from there. And so this is all done via attributes and via, like, you know, you're creating in constructors, you're doing your mapping. So what are the trade-offs, do you think? Like, to me, I would be...
Well, for me...
Well, it would seem easier to write this, but it would seem like, you know, there's some benefits in having XML configuration and that you can swap it out or you can, you know, do some changes on the fly without recompile or whatever.
Yeah, generally, it seems like the, you know, the alt.net crowd is not a fan of sort of littering your code with attributes for dependency injection. Is there something about Ninject that sort of sidesteps that issue? Or, I mean, it seems like Microsoft gets a lot of crap for taking that approach with Unity and MEF, whatever the hell that is.
Well, you don't have to use the attributes. It just makes it more explicit. So, if you read through the Ninject docs, it'll say, you know, so if Ninject happens upon a constructor that takes an interface, it will look through its bindings and do its best to kind of reflect over the assemblies and find something to inject in there, which I thought was kind of cool. I didn't use that part. But one thing that I did to kind of mitigate the idea of having to do my bindings in code was that I put them in a separate project, a separate assembly, essentially. So if I do need to change the bindings, I'm just, you know, plugging in this, you know, module.assembly, you know, module.dll, Ninject module, I think what I ended up calling it or something. Replace that at runtime.
You could go with like a plugin.
It's almost the same as changing the XML file. Right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, load it dynamically and execute at runtime or at startup time. Yeah, but yeah, I didn't want to go the XML config route. Because I did work briefly in the Java world. And if you've ever tried to set up like a Tomcat or a JBoss, you know, based application, they have like 30 config files that all have to be, you know, well-formed, you know, schema-validated XML, case-sensitive, and the whole nine yards. So, you know, I get a twitch whenever I see XML config files.
Like, for instance, a web config.
Oh, yeah, web configs are getting out of control. And if you
that's something that's just getting too big.
If you're doing a lot of if you're doing a TDD approach, you have a you get in the habit of relying on dependency injection for a lot of things. And if you are using XML, which a lot of TDDers will also do, because you don't want some people just don't like attributes in their code. They don't like seeing any of that infrastructure stuff around their classes.
Right.
The XML files, when you start getting into hundreds of components, they're pretty ugly. But I know with Windsor, there's Ayande took a language called Boo, which is this little statically typed programming language for that will run on the CLR. It kind of looks like Python. Actually wrote a DSL to do all the configuration, and it's actually, you can take hundreds of lines of XML and reduce them to just a couple lines of Boo. Basically says, go to this assembly and put stuff together for me. Boo is boo.codehouse.org. It's called friendly language for the CLI.
The only DI system I've worked with so far has been Windsor, and I've been really pleased with it. And, you know, obviously I've learned a ton from Andy's blog too. The approach, the scheme of using conventions for making it easy to dynamically define your DI mappings, I found to be really handy. So, you know, you say everything in this namespace that is a class and has an interface represents a component that should be registered with Windsor. And you can, just by following certain, you know, very simple conventions, or an interface that derives from iPresenter is a presenter interface that should be injected. You know, that kind of stuff can collapse a lot of that configuration goo into very simple code.
That's true. So Ninject, and it's pretty fresh too. He just released, this is the release candidate you've been working with, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he just released it on May 24th, is what the website says.
March.
Definitely wins the prize for the coolest DI website I've seen.
Yeah, and really, really well written introduction. Like, I like how he starts by doing it by hand, because it says you're already doing this, and then I'm making it easier for you, as opposed to like, here's how we're going to do this new thing. I think it's a good way to kind of sell it and kind of ease you into it.
Right. It was the first time that I had really seen it explained that way. You know, so he says, here's how you do it by hand, and here's where, you know, my framework will alleviate all that typing that we're doing. And that's really all we care about with a framework, is elimination of typing. And I don't mean static typing. I mean physical typing. You know, that's why code generation, that's why, you know, frameworks like nHibernate, NT framework, and all these things are popular, because who the heck wants to write, you know, okay, SQL connection equals new SQL connection, you know, right. 50 yeah. times in their code.
Well, that's and bad. Then misspell a column name, or want to, you know, I mean, any of those, you want to rename a column and you're doing a big find replace. I mean, a big thing that I exactly. like about any of these is you're getting strings out of your code where you can. I mean, meaningless strings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So,
and he does address some of the issues by doing it via DSL instead of via XML. And he says, you know, use what you like. And that's another kind of, I guess, feature of the framework, is the developer isn't dogmatic about, you know, his framework. He's like, you know, use what you want to use. If you like this better, I think you'll like this better. But if you don't, there's several other ones out there that are good.
I mean, I guess if you wanted, you could turn the XML into, you could generate a class, or, you know, you could generate your bindings, but if you're doing that, you might as well use an XML first DI system anyways. So, I mean, I understand, there's a lot of attributes that bug the heck out of me, but in this case, I mean, it kind of does give you information about the code. You're looking at it and you're saying this is going to be injected. I'm trying to think through, you know, like, what are the reasons that attributes are generally disliked? I don't like them normally when I see them, but I'm trying to think about why, you know. Like, are they just littering? Is it, are you
it's,
is it
pollution,
like a,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the main complaint I've seen is that when they're used to inject infrastructure concerns into the domain model, that's what I've seen, you know, people complaining about. Mm-hmm. And you know, whether something is injected through a DI framework or not, it's sort of an infrastructure-y kind of concern.
Yeah.
You know, well, does the object really care?
That's something, by the way, that I do think is going to bug people about dynamic data. It's not something you have to do, but to really get the goodness out of dynamic data, the idea is that you take your model and then you put in some attributes that say, okay, this is a credit card number. You know, this field here, I know it's a string, or it's an, you know, a double or whatever in the database, but it's really a credit card number. Or this date here needs to be greater than, you know, 2003, or, you know, like, you put constraints or you put hints about what the your data is, because, you know, there's no credit card number database type, you know, I mean, there's no way that at some point you've got to give that hint, but and so the idea here is that you put that in your model, which is kind of, you know, you're selling your soul from an object point of view, but then it's going to pass that through when it generates out your data or your data entry screens, and it's going to say, okay, this is a credit card number, and it's going to maybe put in, you know, client side JavaScript or you know, it's going to do smart things on your user interface side, but you're putting, I mean, you're really polluting your data model at that point. Well, in a way, but maybe in a way not. I mean, you are saying, you're defining your type. You know what I mean? This is a credit card number.
Right.
But then maybe that should be a class instead.
Well, one concern would be, does it, you know, is it rich enough to handle more than just the simple, you know, validation cases? Does it have a way of saying, okay, you know, if this field is this and this field is this, then, you know, this needs to be true. Like, once you get, one of the problems with attribute-based validation is that it's too simplistic in a lot of ways. And if that's all you have to count on, then eventually you're going to run out of steam.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do think that they built this as kind of like an extensibility system. I mean, going back now to dynamic data, but the idea there is that it's generating out folders, and the folders say, okay, for this table, here's the editing, you know, here's how we define the user interface for, you know, display, edit, delete. And then you can also say, for all calendar controls, I don't want to use the built-in one. I want to use this, you know, flash component, or I want to use this, you know, whatever. And so you really can say on the order table, whenever you display a date, make sure that it has, you know, whatever. Make sure that it has this custom code that I'm putting in, or, you know, a vendor component or whatever. But it is true. I don't know. And then there's the question of, should that be you know, where do you put that? Should that validation be maybe more in the object anyways? I'm just mentioning. Well, we're talking about attributes. I was thinking that's a place where they'll come up and people look at that and go like, well, you're making a trade-off. You know, like your code is not as pretty, but or it's not as clean, maybe as maintainable and that kind of thing. But then get your WhizBang site up quickly.
I'll have to look at it, see if I like it or not. Well. Tune in next week when Scott, John, and Kevin have our weekly session of Twitter bashing and talk about interviewing developers and many more interesting topics.